mile a day. The attack from the north was even slower.
Ike remained 200 miles back at Versailles. The front was not his only worry. He was trying to keep the peace within his command.
There were severe strains during the Battle of the Bulge. Montgomery was perceived in the American army as a rather arrogant, stubborn little fellow. I think General Bradley and others feared that if Monty ever got his hands on our army, he'd never let go.
For months, Monty had been badgering Eisenhower for control of the ground war. After the German breakthrough, Ike had reluctantly given him command of Bradley's troops in the north. But Monty wanted more. He demanded permanent control of all American ground troops. Ike was sick of the field marshal and threatened to have him fired. On the 9th of January, an angry Bradley made the dispute public. Hitler was delighted. This was just the fight he'd hoped for. It took a stirring speech by Winston Churchill to get the Allied generals back in line.
The war went along and every day was like the day before. It was a 7-day-a-week job. It went on forever. For relaxation, General Bradley did algebra problems. And he worked at integral calculus when he was flying an airplane, or flying in his airplane. He said it relaxed him, made him think.
We were always thinking about food. We were always thinking about the cold and how to get warm or how to get dry. And we were always thinking about sleep. You were lucky if you got 2 or 3 hours sleep. And if the sun ever did come out, and it did finally during the latter part, it almost put you to sleep just immediately.
You get extremely tired. When you're marching, carrying a pack and you're going 10, 20 miles up toward the front, you're numb. You're tired. And you can go to sleep walking. It's been done. It's been done a lot. Except the road takes a turn, you go into the ditch.
It's very difficult to sleep if you're shivering with cold. One of the things that you would do, you lie down on your side, you bring your knees up, and you'd be paired with another guy who's facing you, so your knees would go into his stomach, and your head around his head. You have two people in the womb position taking advantage of that position to preserve body heat and life. Another way of doing it to keep you off the snow is you take three men, and you put your arms around each other's shoulder so that you got three bodies, if you will, propping each other up. And then you lower your head, and you go off to sleep, standing up. You never really went off into a deep sleep, sort of half awake, half asleep.
I would go to sleep at night, and my feet would get cold, and I would wake up, and they were numb, and I'd start kicking them together and get circulation started again, and I was good maybe for another hour or so.
I had frozen toes. My big toes were as big as much bigger than a golf ball, and I had many men that I had to send back, and that had feet amputated, the ankles, some of them would just lose the toes.
Halfway through the Battle of the Bulge, the Army was still waiting for its main shipment of winter boots. Men suffering from frozen feet were given whiskey or distilled alcohol to drink, which only made things worse. Some 15,000 soldiers were taken off the line with frostbite.
We went out at dark, as close to the German lines as we could get. And I was to report back to Lieutenant Clausen and report what we'd seen or heard that night. So I went back to the house and told Lieutenant Clausen we didn't hear or see anything. He called, my name was Porkchops in the Army. And he said, Porkchops, you go ahead and lay down here and go to sleep, and I'll wake when I need you. So this was like 7 o'clock in the morning. And I didn't wake up about 12 o'clock that night. And when I woke up, I almost instantly noticed there was something wrong with my feet, and they'd swollen up about a third bigger than they were, you know, and hurt then. And Within 3 days, I was back in England in a hospital.
I saw people that are being evacuated with frozen feet, and their feet were just as black as coal. Kind of maybe a gun steel blue, if you want to put it that way. And in the first stages, they swell quite a bit. But then after that, when they start turning blue and everything, they get almost flat. Kind of turns your stomach, I guess. It's a bad sight.
If you didn't get circulation back within X number of days, I can't remember, 4 or 5 days, then there was a good possibility the gangrene was setting in or had set in. And if you went another 3 or 4 days and you didn't start getting feeling, they amputated feet. Now, I do know there was one boy just about 3 bunks from me. He'd been there a few days before. And when they informed him that he was going to have his left foot removed, I remember that boy like went crazy.
Wild Things. Discovery examines the extraordinary...
of the total American army. But they took 70% of the casualties. Eisenhower was anxiously combing out the rear echelons, looking for men. He didn't need more fancy hardware. In this weather, a lot of it didn't even work. The high command understood. There was only one way to take ground.
The key to the fighting ability of the force is the guy who picks up a rifle, the infantryman, and there aren't that many infantrymen in a division. There are only about 3,200 infantrymen who pick up their rifles and go forward.
From Normandy to Bastogne, I would guess probably our rate of casualties and this type of thing, I have heard the figures of anywhere from 250 to 300%. And that seems a little fantastic because we had a terrific amount of turnover in this type of thing. You'd be there one day and you'd have all new guys the next day.
The arithmetic was simple. The Army had been losing 2,000 men a day for almost a month. New men had to be found to take their place. Physical standards were lowered, training cut short. Many of the recruits were just out of high school. They were ill-prepared and little encouraged. As one assigning officer was fond of telling them, "Most of you aren't coming back. Just as well get used to it now."
They were suddenly loaded into trucks by the numbers and sent off to a division somewhere. And particularly in the Battle of the Bulge, we had men who were sent in as replacements, joining a unit. Sergeants never even got to know their names before they were wounded or killed the next day.
We really didn't get to know them. We just kind of tolerated them, so to speak, and as I look back on it now, I realize that we probably treated them pretty shabbily, and I feel sorry for them. A lot of them were killed, and we never even knew who they were. Somebody said, "We got a couple of casualties. Who are you? Who were they?" And they said, "Oh, a couple of new guys. I don't know what their names are." So somebody had to check the dog tags to find out who they were.
On January the 13th, we were almost to this little town of Cooley, and the artillery started coming in. I had at least 15 of my new men that I knew the names on paper, but I hadn't put the name and the face together yet, because I only had them a week or 10 days. And about 15 of those men were killed just like that, in a period of 10 minutes or less.
The Americans were taking back the Ardennes one small town at a time. First, gunners blanketed the towns with artillery. Then the ground soldiers came out of the woods on foot and in tanks, shooting as they went. When GIs fought their way into a town, the civilians were never in sight.
On menait une vie dans les caves. On essayait de vivre là.
We lived our lives in the cellars. You tried to live there with the means you had, with what you could get to eat. I remember that the water mains had been destroyed. There was no water. So I remember my father went out. It was winter. Everything was frozen, and he brought back the snow, and people melted it to drink it. And this water was black, black from gunpowder, from all the shells exploding in the area.
While civilians prayed in their basements, their towns were falling around their ears. The Belgian town of Houffalize was particularly unlucky. Eisenhower had picked it as the place where the divided armies would join. U.S. forces pulverized Houffalize, trying to get the Germans out. On January 13th, Patton began his final assault. His men were chasing a sinking fox, he insisted, and babbling for the kill.
The German bulge, driven into the Allied lines, American lines, had a start line. And we were pushing them back toward that start line literally with two hands, one from the south, one from the north. And on the 16th at Houffalize, those two hands joined. So you had rejoined, you now had a solid American front, but it still had to go 10 or a dozen miles to win back to the German start line.
The day after Houffalize was taken, Patton congratulated his corps commanders on their victory at the Battle of the Bulge. But whatever the papers said, this fight was not over. It would take 2 weeks to go the last 10 miles. The men at the front were getting almost no replacements. Platoons of 40 had been ground down to 8 or 10. Still, the command ordered them to turn and fight their way east.
And so the fellows, there were a hell of a lot less of them, and they were in terrible shape. Boston guy McCarthy was suffering from both dysentery and upset stomach, and he was throwing up, he was working both ends, and he got awfully weak. And in one attack they went into, he was a sergeant, he passed out right in the middle of the attack. His guys took him over to a haystack, pulled it apart, put him in it, packed him down to keep him from freezing, finished off the attack, and came back and got him later on. It was very tough. They wouldn't send him back. He tried to go back. Nothing sent you back, except big holes. Or dead.
The first quality of a soldier, Napoleon said, is constancy in enduring fatigue and hardship. Courage is only second. In the final stages of the Battle of the Bulge, the men on both sides were spent. Their army's resources dwindled. All that was left was survival of the most primitive kind. The German troops were in tatters, but they kept fighting. If they tried to surrender, they'd likely be shot. German dead were left to freeze where they fell, past the point of pity. American soldiers sat on them like logs to eat their rations. On the 22nd of January, Patton called Bradley and urged that all armies attack, whether they were fatigued or had losses or not. Blood was so short that American field hospitals had to bleed healthy enlisted men. Penicillin was recycled from urine. The instructions to the doctors never changed. Throughout that fall and winter, they salvaged anyone they could and shipped them back to the front.
Men who were wounded and were redeemable were in a very bad position. There's a kind of a merciless rule about sending them back in if they're able to go. And as far as they could tell, it would be repeatedly if they weren't killed or so badly wounded that they were destroyed. It's very hard to forget the expressions in their faces. They have a kind of a hollow-eyed, lifeless, slack-jawed expression, and they almost don't see you as you go by. And you don't, after a while, you learn not to greet them because their minds are elsewhere. It's almost as though they're going through a hopeless doom. And there's a phrase for these men. They were called ragmen. These were infantrymen or infantry medics or such, going back up to a hopeless future or no future, and having no choice in the matter determined, and their practice march, their practice step is, as always, back up where they must go.
It just looked almost endless, like you were going to be there the rest of your life. If you were wounded, you could be out of it for a while. At least that was time that you'd be back in the hospital and could warm up and get something to eat and be able to take a bath and that sort of thing. But then you knew that you had to go back up.
If you're lucky, it's going to be a leg wound. If you're not lucky, it'll be worse. And if you're very, very lucky, you'll take it through the head. Because after you're in combat a while, dying is a lot easier than living. A friend of mine, Ollie, and I fell into a depression in the ground that hardly qualified as a foxhole. We were both numb, absolutely numb with exhaustion. And all he could say for about 24 hours a day was, we got to shoot ourselves. We got to take a bullet to an arm or a leg or somewhere. We got to get out of here because we're never going to make it. He said, we're just never going to make it. And what happened to me is my stomach started to curl up as if I was going to start to cry. And I was afraid I was cracking up. When the enemy's 500 yards away and you got support troops behind you and you're sitting there in a hole with a guy who wants to shoot himself and you're ready to cry, it's not normal. And the other fellow's already cracked.
Four men wounded, one soldier will become a psychiatric casualty. Such men may be shaking or crying, but more often they are just very tired and dirty and depressed. They are unnerved and have no initiative. They're not quitters, but are truly ill.
Tell me, soldier, what's your trouble?
I can't stand seeing people killed.
What were you afraid of?
Everything.
What in particular? What in particular?
Dead.
What?
Dead.
Dead what?
Dead people. I can't stand seeing them.
I can't hear you.
Can't stand seeing dead people.
People who were not necessarily severely wounded, but who were no longer in charge of themselves, they would put them in a detachment or an installation to put them through a kind of a very quick and dirty process in which they were given sodium amytal or one of these other, it's a sort of a truth serum thing, but it was in the form of tablets. And this would give them a very deep, deep sleep, sort of almost a trance-like sleep, for 24, sometimes a 48 hours. During this time, the enlisted men and myself would sometimes go by. We had to supervise it because they'd be screaming and they would be deep, deep asleep and there'd be terrible expressions of their fear and their fright.
You're back on the battlefield now. Watch out, those shells are coming. Watch out!
The assumptions were that this would have some kind of cathartic effect, the sodium amytal, which the men called blue 88s. You know, the most effective artillery piece of the Germans was the 88, and this was blue 88s, because the sodium amytal was a blue tablet. And then they would come out of this, and depending on the dosage, 24, 48, 72 hours, and they'd be walking around completely numb. Sometimes they would be slipping and falling. That took a few more hours. And then they would be given a shower, new clothes, and a pep talk, and the attempt was made to send them back. I say the attempt because it didn't always succeed. They weren't suitable to be returned. And in a sense, the thing that repelled me so badly was that you were talking to men who weren't quite yet still in charge of themselves, and you were sort of shepherding them back to the front. At one time, the chief of staff asked me to go out and talk to him. He said, you're good at that. You go out and talk. And I said, Colonel, I really don't want to do it. He said, I know, Ben. He said, do it anyhow. And I went out and I tried haphazardly to try to get them, to persuade them to get in their trucks and go back. They'd finished with their 72 hours. They'd gotten their clothes. And they just looked at me, and half of them looked as if they couldn't focus. And finally, one of them said, "Don't you guys understand? If you can still walk and see, they'll keep shipping you back." So I didn't do that again. And I told my commanding officer,
In the last few days of January, American troops made their way back to the original lines, the ones they'd held before the German offensive began. The books on the Battle of the Bulge were closed. 16,000 Americans had been killed. 60,000 more wounded or captured. German casualties were said to be twice that. There was no ceremony to mark the end of the battle, not even a headline. The GIs simply kept moving forward into Germany.
The Battle of the Bulge would be remembered as the great surprise of the campaign in Europe. I think General Bradley would hold that it speeded the end of the war because the German took so many casualties, and when he was as severely defeated as he was in the Battle of the Bulge, it helped end the thing by May. An intelligence failure. Certainly, we didn't know he was coming. When you look back on the record now, you can say, hey, you should have seen this, or you should have seen that, or anticipated this. I don't think anyone did.
When we started to make our way back into the Ardennes, it was something quite amazing. Emerging from the snow, the white, were two things. Houses that were destroyed, because the villages were practically all destroyed, and huge black holes, vast numbers of them, in the fields. It was an apocalyptic landscape. Really, a madman wouldn't have been able to imagine such a landscape. People had been buried, but very summarily, because in winter, everything was frozen. It was frightening. And our parents, of course, tried to keep us from those places. Still, they were everywhere, these bodies half buried. It was 2 or 3 years before they managed to find the bodies of all the soldiers that had fallen.
Or something, I'll think about those days during the Bulge. It brings back memories of the friends that I lost and the desperate feeling that we had in those days. And it kind of irks me that after 50 years, I still think that way. I should forget it, go on about my life, but I guess it made such an impression, it'll always be with me.
Memories are there a lot more vividly, even after 50 years, than probably what I did yesterday. I can tell you how deep the snow was. I can tell you the color of the snow and the blood the next morning. I know what equipment I had on. I know the words that we said. They stay with you.
doesn't go away. It sleeps sometimes. But then it awakens again. Things are happening. People are doing things that you never dreamed you'd ever see or hear about. It's an enormity of an experience. And everything after that has been a footnote.